This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the City Council in Philadelphia rejects the idea of Black community control of the police, so activists take the concept directly to the people. And the Black and Indigenous peoples of Colombia, South America, demand that the government respect their rights to collective ownership of the land.
But first, the Black is Back Coalition is preparing for its annual march on the White House and National Conference on November 4th and 5th. The theme of the conference is the ballot and the bullet. Elections, war, and peace in the era of Donald Trump. We spoke with Black is Back Chairman Omali Yeshetela.
What we saw with the election of Donald Trump was a ruling class in disarray, various sectors of the ruling class fighting for control of the state through the electoral process, and Trump trounced them all. And what he did was expose the hypocrisy of elections as something that the U.S. only likes when it's in absolute control and can determine the outcome. And to see that working inside the country, when we've seen the U.S. demand elections in places like Palestine, and then once they don't get what they want, they negate the outcome of those elections. Same thing happened in Venezuela and other places. But now to see it happen inside the country and to see Trump trumpeting the fact that the elections are purchased, that all of the candidates are purchased, whoever's running for office, et cetera. And I think that's something that many people will be able ultimately to understand about the social system, the electoral process, and the fact that it doesn't serve the people, but it's just this process that allows the rulers to compete nonviolently for control of the state, something that we will play a role in helping people to understand. I think the other thing about during the era of Donald Trump is that more people who don't seem to have other means by which they know how to struggle are looking at the electoral process. Some are pushed completely out of it, but there are others who are looking to the electoral process trying to fix whatever they think was wrong the last time, what happened with Hillary, why not Bernie, that kind of thing. And so I think the question of elections under Trump is something that is really highlighted and gives us an opportunity to explain this thing and expose the profound, deep contradictions of it, and that elections are not biblical. It's not something that's written in the Bible. And even if elections were written in the Bible, we've seen not only the inadequacy of the election, but it's been shown that given free reign, given the natural course of events with the electoral process under this capitalist system, the elections will not serve us. But what we have had an opportunity to do, precisely because the elections were so dominant, the ideas and the people paid more attention to this election, I imagine, than they have in a lot of elections in the last period, it gave us an opportunity to march into that area of attention of the people and say, look, if you're going to do these elections, then these are some things that we have to demand of the system and use the election to demand these things of the system, which drives the contradictions to the surface, and then it promotes the interests of Black people so that we're not just participating in an election, but there are actual objectives that we are fighting for. And that's why I think what the coalition did in terms of the National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination was so important, so that we've begun to forge within, and certainly a community that often characterizes itself as an activist community, we've begun to forge a general kind of consensus and some kind of direction about what these elections should call for, what they should demand. And we've seen evidence of the significance of that, not all of it positive, but just at what we're looking at in Ferguson, St. Louis area, where protests are unfolding even at this moment. We have these choreographed kinds of movements where people really don't have any demands, and the rulers are offering up body cameras and even offering them up for free for at least a year. That how inadequate that is, and the fact that Black community control of the police is something that our coalition put forth. We had a national conference on it in Ferguson to raise that demand, and we're pushing that even now. So I think that the work of the coalition, the significance of it being reinforced every day, and Trump gives us a splendid opportunity to do these things.
One of the things that one observed before Ferguson in general was that the black political establishment had stopped making demands. And since Ferguson, we've seen some confusion, even among activists, as to the demand-making process.
Yeah, I think that's right. And this sector, these neocolonial puppet forces, I think they have become more and more exposed with the depth of the crisis that's being experienced in this country today. That they're not playing any role, not only the ones who are elected, but even if you look at the charlatans, the Sharptons, and the Jacksons, and all of this stuff, that they're almost passe, that they don't play any fundamental roles, and I think that they are being exposed. So they have no demands. What can they demand? They can't step outside of the parameters established by the system. They can't even do as much as Trump is doing, who has stepped outside of the traditional trajectory of the white ruling class in this country. But the black politicians, elected and not elected, are unable to do even that. And again, I think that's why the coalition is so significant. Because, you know, we saw a sort of a black political agenda coming out of Gary, Indiana in 1972. And there were some lofty words that were passed there. And this was at the time where the black movement was actually being crushed and had almost been crushed. And we had a few thousand people come to Gary. They made good speeches. They came up with good declarations. And then as soon as the damn thing was over, the Democratic Party called these Democratic representatives who participated in Gary, called them in, spanked their butts, made them withdraw, made them stop their participation. But this is something they can't do with what the Black is Back Coalition is doing, because it is not connected to, not tied to, these black politicians in office or the ones who are not in office. And that's something that's really important. And one thing that gave us the advantage is that when we started this coalition and initiated a march on the White House when Obama was there, and it drew a line, a definitive line, between those who wanted to go against imperialism, what we found is that some of those forces who we had respected in the 1960s and 70s, who we thought were really profound leaders, actually were able to unite with imperialism as long as they had a black face in the form of Obama. And it was almost as if they were saying, there but by the grace of God go I, when they looked at Obama. And so they retreated and they became pro-imperialist. They might call it pro-Obama, but they knew better. These are people who prided themselves in their intellectual prowess as Marxists and revolutionaries, et cetera, and they went for Obama. And so now this was one of the things that actually contributed to the position that the coalition is in right now at this very moment, in terms of being able to affect real struggle and to challenge the general narrative that has been established, even if broadly so. And by that I mean we are a coalition, so we don't have a specific kind of political line around every question, but we do have a line around self-determination. We are firmly committed to self-determination, and we have come up with a national black agenda for self-determination that all of us are supposed to be committed to. And even if all of us do not uphold them, we've established the basis for criticism and self-criticism within this broad group of forces who represent the coalition. So I think we're in good stead, and I think that the U.S. government is experiencing our presence, and I think more and more black people and others are experiencing our presence as well.
Yes, Obama is gone, but more than half of the Congressional Black Caucus went along with one of the biggest defense or war budgets in history, and we don't see a chorus of opposition to that from these black civic organizations.
We do not see a chorus of opposition to that, nor do we see a chorus of opposition to the black elected officials' unity with this massive deployment of military forces in the African community itself. As you know, they had an opportunity to vote that thing down, that is to say, the utilization of what they like to call surplus military weapons in our communities, and they all supported it. And I think that if we should hold true and do what we're supposed to do, if we get people to come out to our mobilizations and use these conferences that we have been doing effectively, then we can contribute to people coming out with a much better understanding of what it is that we're dealing with as a people in this struggle for our liberation.
Well, certainly the FBI has noted Ferguson and the change that has been wrought, at least at some levels, in the Black Liberation Movement. They've come up with a whole new category to describe, I guess, Black politics in general. They're going after what they describe as Black identity extremists, whatever that is.
Yeah, that's what they want to make it. And I tell you that I heard someone say, and I think it's true, if they've come up with a category, they've got a program. And the category is broad enough, just as it was a Black nationalist hate groups they used with the FBI, the counterintelligence program in the 1960s. This broad term that even embraced everybody from the Nation of Islam to JOMO to Black Panther Party and whomever they want to throw into the mix. And even the SCLC was thrown into that. And so now they come up with Black identity extremists. And that can be anybody as well. And obviously that would be us, because they use such terms. It was almost like you had to swear the loyalty oath if you were Black to the American government. It's almost like they're creating the basis for trying people for thought crimes. If you don't seem loyal enough, if you think that the American government is unjust, if you think about denying your citizenship to this country or anything like that, can be characterized as this Black identity extremist. If you think of Black people as a separate entity, it doesn't matter that everything that happens by this government proves that we are a separate entity, that they are killing Black children and executing Black men and women in the streets and in their homes in this country. It's clear evidence that there's something different here, but you can't act like it. You can't say that. If you say that, that identifies us as some kind of domestic terrorist organization. This is what they're putting forward. But I think it's really important for us to understand this, that the United States government and imperialism in general is in a really desperate place, that things are becoming unleashed, they're unraveling throughout the world. And there's no place where the imperialists have absolute control, that they want to make sure that everybody is either disarmed or absolutely united with what the United States government wants. And if you're not, then you're a threat. Whether that's Iran, they don't want to have any ability to defend itself, whether that's in Venezuela, Korea, and whether that's in Ferguson and in the Black communities in this country, everybody has to be defenseless, because the people who are driving this crisis of imperialism are the people who are struggling to free ourselves from 500-600 years of imperialist domination, and that this whole political economy rests upon the exploitation, the severe, brutal, deadly, murderous exploitation of people who are held under colonial domination, who are experiencing occupation in one form or another. And so this is what's part of what's driving them with this whole question of Black identity extremists, just like they have Iranian identity extremists and Afghan identity extremists, anybody who has awakened to their own interests and seem to be willing to struggle to achieve their own interests if it comes at the expense of the imperialist arrangement is a threat. And that, in my view, is a sign of our significance and why it's so important that we do what we do.
If Black identity extremist categorization is a new COINTELPRO, or a sign that COINTELPRO never died, there is a difference between now and the 1970s, when COINTELPRO supposedly was canceled. And that is, COINTELPRO's practices were acknowledged to be illegal, unconstitutional, beyond legality. But much of what the FBI does now that looks COINTELPRO-ish has been sanctified as legal since 9/11.
Yeah, but I think that's absolutely true. But I think also it was easier for the U.S. government to declare that it was illegal and for all the liberals to hold their hearings and congressional hearings to track what the government had done to do such horrible things to our movement and our people. But that was after the revolution was defeated. It was easy to say that after they didn't have a real contest anymore, that it shouldn't be done. Today, this thing is unfolding rapidly before their eyes, and they're trying to contain it. Bush tried to attain it in many similar ways to what Trump is doing now, not only with wars and threats of wars against people around the world, but even extra legal means, creating new draconian laws and methods to challenge the people, because the crisis was rearing its head in a certain specific way, with more and more peoples around the world fighting back. And what has happened today that's so important and that the FBI indicated was Ferguson. And not that Ferguson was new, but how it happened in Ferguson and the young community black working class forces when they rose up, and they were able to hold the attention of the world long enough in the era of social media where people had to pay attention, and it really excited black people throughout this country and raised the morale of a community that had been seeing all these killings by police and no meaningful kind of response. And then there was Ferguson, where the initial slogan coming from the people was kill the police, not hands up, don't shoot, not Black Lives Matter, but kill the police. And it really raised the morale of black people here, and it's created a whole different situation for them that makes this black identity extremism, as they would characterize it, different now. Because now black people are talking about being black, which wasn't happening just 4 years ago. You didn't have this kind of generalized discussion that you're having today. And the U.S. government is concerned that what happened in Dallas, what happened in Louisiana with Cosmo Johnson, I think his name was, what happened in these places would become generalized. And there is a generalized consciousness growing among the African community, which means that there's a growing willingness of people to grow, to learn, and to fight back, and to fight back using any means necessary and possible.
So in a sense, the FBI's reclassification exercise is really an acknowledgement that today there is, after all these years, decades of stagnation in the black movement, that finally there's a black movement that's worthy of the FBI getting upset about.
Certainly in its incipient stage. It's in its incipient stage now, and I think that's what they are trying to attack now. And I think that's one of the reasons why our coalition is so important. Because one of the things the coalition does that I think was missing in general terms in the 60s, there were different organizations that had revolutionary messages, revolutionary politics, and what have you. But I think the coalition is offering up a scientific approach to struggle, to examining society itself, things like that, taking us out of just the candlelit storefronts and religious and other kinds of ceremonies, and attaching the conditions and struggles of our people to actual empirical evidence in this world of what is happening and what we have to do. And I think we have an opportunity here with this coalition to do something that hasn't been done in a very long time. And even the way we've been working now for 8 years, we've been raising up the question of self-determination. That's been something we've said over and over and over again. That's been our mantra. That's been the thing that has distinguished us from many of the kinds of spontaneous and other activities that we've seen happening in this country that characterize itself as some kind of movement, self-determination. And this general characterization, even though there are different factions and sectors who have different interpretations of what that means, the idea of self-determination is something that I think the U.S. government and our oppressors find extremely troubling, and actually may and probably will help us to be defined as black identity extremists, because self-determination, people being in charge of their own affairs, I think is something that the U.S. government is opposed to, as we see again in Afghanistan and Iraq and Iran and other places around the world. The same thing is true in the United States.
In Washington early next month, the Black is Back Coalition will, of course, march on the White House on Saturday, November 4th. And on Sunday, you'll be at Howard University for a national conference. What can we expect at that conference?
I think that we can expect further elaboration on the significance of the 19 points of the National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination. But I think we can also expect an examination of where we are today. And I think also we're going to have to talk about this FBI characterization, classification of the black identity extremists. I think we're going to have to take it out of the closet. Don't allow it to be something that people read about it in specialized journals and things like this, but take it out of the closet. Make it something that everybody is aware of, so that it becomes more difficult for the program to be used against us. And I say program because I guarantee you, if they've got a classification, they've got a program, and it's at work, you know, even as we have this discussion. So I think that you're going to see different forces, different ideological expressions, you know, coming forward. And that's going to be a great display of unity, even with the differences that I know exist within the bodies, you know, from people from the Black Alliance for Peace, with people like Jamal Baraka, and people who are coming from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, like Khalid Rahim and the New African Independence Party, and people who are coming from Chicago, from the Amos T. Wilson Group, and talking about reparations, and the African People's Socialist Party, and just various other forces who will be there. And of course, the Black Agenda Report will be highly represented there and coming from a variety of ideological places, but showing an incredible amount of unity in terms of a common opposition to imperialism, to war, to the grotesque brutality that's imposed on black people here and oppressed people around the world by the United States government and by imperialism in general. I think that it's going to be an extremely important event that people need to come out to and also have an opportunity to join with the various organizations, to join with the coalition, and to get involved in deepening this crisis of a social system that can only survive by sucking the blood of African people and oppressed people around the world and all of the exploited masses. And so this is going to be an incredibly important, I believe crucial, event that we're having at Howard University on the 5th. And I think the mobilization is going to be equally significant. So people have an opportunity to get involved. And you don't have to be committed to any particular organization to do this. All you got to do is believe in self-determination. I think it's our responsibility, those of us who do believe in self-determination, to get off our asses and stop complaining about what the liberals are doing over here and those are doing over there, unless we are prepared to at least show our presence in making a statement that determination is what we have to have if we are ever going to see a future as a people.
That was Somali Yeshitela, chairman of the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace and Reparations.
Diop Olugbala is a Black Is Back activist in Philadelphia, where he was one of the organizers of a local conference on Black community control of the police.
We had a number of different workshops. It was held in the middle of North Philly in the oppressed African community, a lot that we had liberated, and we turned that into a meeting ground. And people came from throughout the neighborhoods, and of course, different organizations and activists were there. On the agenda was the general overview, the political overview that was written by Chairman Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the Black Is Back Coalition. That overview, which was written for the 2015 National Conference on Black Community Control of Police, which was held in Ferguson, Missouri. And we read that overview to inform the discussion that was held at the local conference we just had. We had a lot of good discussion around that and then reported to the people on the status of our struggle to have the Black Community Control of Police built through City Council and now the mayor's office. We had discussion on Cop Watch and the need to build programs in the community to not only monitor the activities of the police, but to build fighting capacity amongst the people to intervene in the injustices that are committed against us by the pigs. We also discussed the question of reparations as it relates to the struggle for Black community control of the police. One of the principles of the resolution of the bill includes the demand for seizure of the Philadelphia police budget, which in total is about $1.4 billion when you include the prisons and the courts. And we're saying that the resources are the wealth that is being spent on police activities in Black community need to be seized and redirected towards program for economic development for those same oppressed communities. And we had really important presentations in that workshop given by Brother Ismael Jimenez, Sister Megan Malachi, and other forces participated in the discussion to help us understand what an education system would look like under the control of the Black community and with access to the resources that I just discussed. Also, we had discussion on the next steps towards building a mass movement to getting the Black Community Control of Police bill passed through, again, the City Council and the mayor's office. So we signed people up to be part of the petition effort, as well as to participate in upcoming political actions. We want to be ever present everywhere. The city council, mayor, and other elected officials who have the ability to pass the bill, the Black Is Back Coalition needs to be on the scene, and they face putting Black community control of police in the center of discussion. So these are some things that were discussed at the conference. It was very powerful, and we plan to do this on a regular basis, at least four times a year.
Now, you took the bill to the city council earlier, but got no support, and in fact, several of you were arrested.
Yeah, that's correct. We took the bill to the first city council meeting, which was held September 14th, coming out of their recess, and It's a bill that raises up the democratic demand for the black community to have its own independent, democratically elected black community controller police commission, which would have the power to hire, fire, train, and discipline or subpoena police forces that violate the rights of the people. And we put this on the agenda and demanded an answer from City Council and its president, Darryl Clark. Their response was to send the police after us. They put us in handcuffs and threw us in a paddy wagon and detained us, held us for several hours before releasing us with citation, talking about disrupting the flow of City Council or something to that effect. And subsequent to that struggle, Darryl Clark told the media that City Council does not have the authority to pass such a bill, and B, that his interpretation or his version of the solution to the police assaults on our community is to beef up the budget for the existing police advisory board, which is an entity that has no power and was actually set up by the powers that be, by white power, to deny the black community any real power. The police advisory board does not have power to hire, fire, train, or subpoena, and therefore is useless in the struggle to get justice for black people. And further, if Clark and City Council wanted to, they could express their unity with the demand for the bill and join forces with us in struggle with Mayor Jim Kenney to have a Black Community Controller Police Ordinance passed, which the mayor does have the ability to do. And therefore, our next strategic struggle will be not only to maintain the pressure on City Council, but also to bring the struggle for Black Community Controller Police to the mayor's front steps. And this is what we intend to do.
You were arrested for allegedly vandalizing a statue of the late mayor and former police chief Rizzo. What relationship will the protests against the Rizzo statue have to the ongoing demand for black community control of the police?
Well, it depends on who's holding the demonstration, because in fact, prior to my arrest, around painting the statue, there were Black Lives Matter-led protests. There was a white man named Brandon Templin who threw eggs at the statue. And none of these acts were in relationship to the Black Community Controller Police struggle, which is part of what made the act of painting Black Power on the statue, as well as Black Community Controller Police on its front steps, significant as a call for honest forces who are truly opposed to what Rizzo stood for to unite with the strategic demand for power in the hands of the black community, because reality is that it is the police that stand between the people and the statue. So we call on all the forces I named to unite with the actions that we plan to hold against Kenny, City Council, as well as my upcoming trial. And we also have allies with whom we currently work that will be at the trial and also who are actively participating in the organized struggle for black community control of the police. And those forces constitute the Black Community Control of Police Task Force, which the Black is Back Coalition formed shortly after our Chicago National Conference.
Now, I believe Philadelphia has a majority black city council, but it appears that these black city council persons have abdicated any responsibility for the police.
Oh, none at all. They don't take any responsibility for how the pigs move in our community. And this is further evidence of the need for the black community itself to build dual and contending power over our lives and the institutions in our communities. And this is a large part of what was actually discussed at the local conference on Black Community Control of Police we just held in North Philly. Because we, in many ways, one could see what happened at the conference as the real city council meeting where genuine leadership in the black community opened up these questions to the people. The people were allowed to be a part of the organized struggle, unlike what you see in city council meetings where the agenda is predetermined, has no relationship to the demands of the masses, and decisions are made without any input from the people at all. So we have no illusions concerning how city council or where they stand on the question of the police and the economic extraction of the black community. And this is why we are actively building dual and contending capacity to govern ourselves and our own communities. And this is largely what the People's Law School for Black Justice and the Cop Watch and other programs we discussed at the conference This is largely what this is all about.
That was Diop Olugbala of the Black Is Back Coalition in Philadelphia.
In Colombia, South America, the government has signed a peace deal with FARC guerrillas to end a 60-year war. Part of that agreement calls on the government to recognize Black and Indigenous Colombians' collective right to land and to develop their own economies. However, Charo Mena Rojas of the Afro-Colombian organization Black Community Process says the government has resisted actual implementation of the agreement.
The government has no intention, no goodwill whatsoever of include ethnic perspective on the implementation of the agreements. They have no interest, and really they don't want to ensure that the rights of indigenous and black peoples are protected and are respected. And I have to also remind your listeners that the black people, the Afro-descendant people, is the most disadvantaged. Although we have Law 70 and some legal provisions that protect our collective and territorial rights, especially territorial rights, which is very important for us, we are in an enormous disadvantage because of the racism that involves every action in this country. This is not a country that is ready to accept that black Afro-descendant people have specific rights to be respected, particularly territorial rights. And some of the provisions in this peace agreement had to do a lot, and this is the most prioritized component of the agreements for the government, has to do a lot with territorial rights, with the rights of people in the territories that black people are placed in. So last week, we have to stop this conversation, this work with the government to say here are no conditions really for any other technical discussions, and we have to move a more political discussions with the high-level body that is in charge of the implementation of the agreement, which is the committee that is comprised by 3 members of government, 3 members of FARC. They are in charge of the implementation, the verification, the follow-up of the agreements. We are expecting from them a response for a meeting on a specific date and time to meet, to sit down and meet with them and see if we have come to a consensus and finally have this ethnic perspective and the agreements. If this doesn't happen, then we have to see for other ways of pressuring the government.
How did you come to the conclusion that the government has no intention of bargaining in good faith or honoring its agreements with Afro-Colombians and with indigenous people?
Well, the government is formulating this plan on how the agreement is going to be implemented. And the content of this plan is going to be part of the national development plan. What we did was to, as I say, come together, all the groups, and design our own proposal with the goals, with the indicators, with the resources, everything that a plan contains. What happened was that they only wanted to include very, very basic indicators with no measures, with nothing that will say how you will measure that a specific program, a specific project in ethnic territories regarding the peace process effectively is beneficial for the indigenous or the black communities. How do you measure that collective titling have been happening, which is one very specific interest that we have. We need that communities that don't have collective titles yet have collective titles because it's a way to protect their territorial rights. So the way to measure that is that you say a specific number of percentage of the land fund that the government is going to put together to respond to the one of the agreements, a specific percentage of that fund has to go to indigenous and Afro-descendant people and ethnic people. The government didn't want to put a specific percentage of a specific number. They only want to say, well, collective title will happen. that doesn't allow us to measure anything. If you go at the end of 2-3 years to look at the agreement and say, okay, how this have benefit Black people that have no collective title of their lands, ancestral lands, then not say if there was any improvement, because you don't have a specific numbers to say we had this much, we have 10 people that need a collective title, now we have 2 or 3. That allows you to see how much improvement we have and how much we need to work to reach the goal that we have. Without that, we are doing absolutely anything. And the government didn't want to do this kind of very specific, I mean, this basic on planning. They have no intention of doing that. But the other part that is critical is there are no resources. There are really no money to put into the plan for indigenous and for Afro-descendant people. There is no money for Black people to effectively develop any actions, programs, projects in this process of implementation of the agreement.
One might suspect that the government is unwilling to be specific about giving collective titles to Black people or to indigenous people because it wants to distribute the land to corporations and favored folks.
Exactly. One of the priorities of the government with this agreement is precisely in point one, which is around the rural development. It has to do everything with the interest of corporations, the economic interest of corporations and the landowners, and nothing to do with the interest and the territorial rights of Black people particularly, especially since we don't have the same kind of protections and provisions that the indigenous have. And many of the territories where Black people are located still don't have collective titles. So what the risk that we are facing here is that when the government is going to put together this fund, this land fund, to apparently provide land to campesinos, right? We are not campesinos. We are ethnic people. We are Black people that have a specific right, even though we work the land, we have to be identified with this specific, very concrete rights on ancestral territories that allowed us to have collective titles. So that's why we make the difference. So if we don't have these titles, what the government is going to end up saying is that these are empty lands, and therefore they own those lands, and therefore they can do whatever they want with these lands. And this is going to end dispossessing Black people from the territories where they have been for centuries. So this is one of the risks that we are facing, and it's obviously for us the reason why the government doesn't want to commit with very specific numbers and measures that allowed later to see how effectively the peace agreement and the accords are bringing benefits and respecting the rights and promoting the rights of Black people.
From what you're saying, it appears that the government does not really respect the principle of collective land, land collectively held by an ethnic group, in this case, Black Colombians.
Absolutely. They have no intention of respecting the rights of collective titling, but furthermore, they have no interest in respecting a principle and obligation that is on the agreements through the ethnic chapter, which is to ensure that there is no regret of the rights of Black people and indigenous peoples too. So we have to struggle gain these rights that the agreement cannot push back. And with these kind of provisions, and I have to remind people also that there has been also a process, a fast-track process, to provide some ruling and some legal provisions that are very negative for the rights of Black people and indigenous people in many ways. So with these legal provisions, with this negativity to include ethnic perspectives on this plan, what the government is doing is not complying with the ethnic chapter, not complying with the agreement itself, by ensuring that there is no regression, pushback of the rights that we have gained through struggle.
You speak in terms of regression because Afro-Colombians had secured agreements years ago for collective land rights in that country.
Precisely. We have the Law 70 that was signed in 1993. It comes from a constitutional change in 1990 with an article, the 855 in the Constitution. It is linked to the ILO 169 Convention, also that is very specific about the rights of indigenous and tribal peoples, which we fit pretty well into those notions. And there are other set of legal provisions in Colombia that ensure us several rights, including territorial rights in different ways, and in terms of environment, in terms of authorities, like the community councils as territorial autonomous authorities, in terms of development. We have the right to define our own ways of development and decide how is good living for us, is how we see development. Several provisions, national and international, that the government must follow up that protect our rights. So when we say that it has to make sure that there are no regression or pushback of our rights, is because there are many provisions at the national and international level that protect those rights.
And these collective land rights and development rights are intertwined with the security situation in Colombia, as dramatized by a massacre of campesinos last week in black territories.
Absolutely. What happened with this massacre, which we regret profoundly because it's life lost, is that first of all, because of the presence of armed groups and all these interests of territorial controls in areas where black people and indigenous people have been located, and we have denounced this many, many times, coca starts growing in certain areas where black people is located, not by black people, but by foreigners. And in this particular region, these coca crops have been linked to different forms of armed groups, including the guerrilla, being by taxing or protecting, providing protection either way as an economic activity. So when guerrillas enter into the peace process and give up the arms, what happens is other armed groups take the place of guerrilla and seize control of the economic, political control, and armed control, mostly on these territories. Now, the lack of presence of government, the lack of inclusion of an ethnic perspective on the agreements from the first place, from the dialogues in Cuba, and the lack of consultation of black people, black authorities, ethnic authorities on those territories for the programs of eradication and the substitution of coca crops is that this massacre happened. So everything that is happening is happening in black territories, is impacting the lives and the rights of black people, is impacting the territories which we consider are also a victim, a subject of rights and victim, and is all product of the lack of consultation and participation and avoidance of respecting the rights of black people in the territories. This is a collective title land where this massacre happened. It's in a community council that has been taken by armed groups, initially guerrillas and now in paramilitaries and government forces and narcotraffic forces. Now that guerrillas are out, then narcotraffic and paramilitaries and army forces are in there, all involved in armed encounters, meaning that war continues to be in this territory. But this is a collective title, community council, a territory that has been impacted by the fact of, by the lack of participation and consultation of the ethnic authorities in the process of implementation of the peace agreement.
So in other words, as a result of the FARC laying down their arms, the government and narco traffickers and paramilitaries have gone into these black areas rather than collaborating with Afro-Colombians who have title to that land.
Yeah, they don't have any intention to collaborate with the Afro-Colombians. They have been fighting with us for the control of those territories. I have to say, this is a community council in the south region of the Pacific coast in Colombia, near Ecuador. And it's one of the biggest community councils that we have with collective title. And this has been a fight of the community council for decades to protect the territories from the different armed groups. Initially it was guerrillas, I say, but there have been paramilitaries and narco traffic and even army involved in disputing the control of the territorial control with the community council, which has a collective title and therefore all the rights that are by law entitled to. So now what is happening is that these other groups continue disputing with the community councils. I have to remind people that a major crime was committed against this community council by the assassination of one of their main leaders, Genaro Garcia, by FARC, right in the middle of the dialogues with the government last year before the agreement was signed, precisely because the community council has been so strong on defending their territorial rights. But the matter of fact that the government also ignored the local authorities, the autonomous authorities, and having consulted them with the program for the eradication and the changes of coca crops is problematic, because this massacre happens because the coca growers don't want eradication. This is an area with heavy cultivation of coca. In the agreements, there is a provision to eradicate and change these coca crops to these people's ways of living. But these programs needed to be consulted also with the ethnic authorities in the territory, such as the community council of this particular river. When these consultations don't happen, and when the government doesn't comply with the agreements that has made with the coca growers, what happened is this massacre. Because instead of complying with the agreements of processes to eradicate manually and provide the resources to transform these coca areas with other kind of products, what the government has done, and in part is because following policies by the United States, is forcing the eradication. When people come to confront that forced eradication is when the massacre happens. Now, if this will be also a process of consultation with the owners of those lands, which are the community council, the black community people, then perhaps a different process will happen and this massacre will be avoided. The rights of black people wouldn't be violated, and the rights of the land as a victim wouldn't be violated either. So this is what is happening right now in this territory. And of course, this comes with the threatening to the leaders of the community councils, which has forced us to put together a mission to go to the territories and provide some support to the community councils because of the high risk that they are confronting right now with the armed groups in that area.
Are Afro-Colombians preparing to provide their own security in those territories?
We have some specific measures to provide own security, but we have to be honest that this is beyond our capacity. There are paramilitary and narco-traffic groups are heavily armed and in big, big numbers. And we really don't have capacity to provide own security at the level that this will be needed. Really, the state, the government should provide their responsibility and ensure that leaders, communities, and other people are not assassinated. There are certain measures that we can take, but most of all, we need to ensure that there is high visibility of the situation, because these are very, very isolated areas. So it's very little said about what is really happening in these territories. So one of the ways to provide better security and avoid certain safety issues is providing a high, very high visibility on what is happening there. That way, it forced the government to make presence and take responsibility.
And high visibility could also involve people from outside Colombia who are indicating that they have their eyes on what the Colombian government is doing and what the United States government is doing regarding these territories.
Absolutely. That is very, very important for us, that eyes from the human rights community internationally are there, but especially that are outspoken about the situation, that tell the government that they are very well informed, that they are monitoring, that they are following up, and pressure the government to comply with the law and with the agreements. You got to pay attention, particularly the inclusion of an ethnic perspective on these agreements, which is something that can be historical. So for Colombia to include an ethnic perspective, which means that the rights of indigenous black people, their own people, are respected, are included in this peace process, the voices and the effective presence of the ethnic people is involved in this process, is going to be a landmark. And the government must understand this, and I think the international community can play a role.
That was Charo Mena Rojas speaking from Colombia, South America.
Charles Diggs is a longtime inmate at the Graterford State Prison in Pennsylvania. He's written an essay for Prison Radio titled Fear of Love.
Young African-Americans, Hispanics, and poor whites are coming to prison. Most of them did not complete high school, and all of them, in my opinion, were economically depressed. After 42 years of imprisonment, I'm a paralegal. I've done many cases and helped the men with their legal matters, and all of them are related to economics. And what we have is drug sentences, small-time crime, small felonies, theft, robbery, that has caused a great overpopulation of unnecessary people in prison. And they are the ones who keep coming back and forth. They make the constant prison population, the short-timers, as they say. In the meantime, they have us lifers with no parole in Pennsylvania and many other states. And so you have a geriatric population that has actually aged out. Crime is a young man's, I would say, sport, because most people get involved in crime, they don't even take it seriously. You'd be amazed how people are in jail and they finally realize what they've done was fatal. And then we also have a group of men who are innocent of their crimes. And another large percentage are men and women who have been overcharged. In other words, they may have a robbery. They got 8 or 9 charges with the robbery. You know, and this is what forces many citizens to plead guilty. The next aspect of my argument deals with when you are 50 years of age and you've served a substantial number of years in prisons, the medical experts say you should add 15 years onto your 15 years. And that is because of the diet, the water, and the stress of long imprisonment. Many people don't understand that stress is the cause of many of your illnesses, heart disease, cancer. It creates all those fatal diseases by being under stress for long periods of time. The question should be, why aren't life-term prisoners and other long-term prisoners considered for release? The nation is talking about second chances in America, but they're only talking about drug abuses. They're not talking about the vast number of prisoners been in prison 5, 10, 15, 20 years, 30, some 40 and 50 years. And there seems like there's no movement towards dealing with that elderly population, which they would pose no threat to society. And they've even got a couple of geriatric prisons in this state, and other states are beginning to make geriatric wards in different of your housing areas. There should be some type of redemption in punishment. There should be some type of mercy in punishment. You know, as the old maxim says, you know, punishment without mercy is no justice at all. So we have to begin to put justice incorporate into the judicial system. And all these systems are related. The prosecutor's office, the courthouses, the prisons, probation and parole, and the police officer on the street who makes the initial arrest. And we really put too much pressure on a police officer. We expect them to solve all these social, economic, and mental health issues. And it's just not going to happen until we change the whole philosophy of dealing with citizens who have come in violation of the law. The challenge takes vision and the imagination, something that the founding fathers had. They had enough courage to embrace a vision, imagination. And we should take on that same imagination to imagine something different than over 1,500 prisons all over the country. And they're still building. The change will take courage. And the only energy that I believe that will allow change if we bring love into the justice system.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.